I am Neil. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today's topic is argument against the individual. In Latin, it is ad hominem. We're going to discuss debating techniques where one person makes an argument and his opponent decides that instead of attacking the argument, he will attack the person making the argument. The problem with this is that it is a logical fallacy. It is kind of the inverse of the appeal to authority, which is another logical fallacy, where a person attempts to support their position by claiming that someone important also believes their position. That would be an appeal to authority, and it is a logical fallacy. In this logical fallacy, though, the ad hominem, which is the attack against the individual, instead of using a person to support your position, the person attacks the argument, but it doesn't do so directly. They go around the argument and attack the person. There are several subtypes to this form of logical fallacy. Obviously, the main one is the direct insult. You make an argument, and you're supporting your position, and your opponent, rather than replying to your argument, usually because they can't, they don't have the evidence, they don't have the facts, or your argument is sound. But what they do in that case is they then attempt to distract you or any listeners from the fact that they do not have a reply to that argument, and instead they attack you personally. The purpose is to get you to defend against their attack against you. If they succeed in doing that, then you will start defending yourself, and they will have succeeded in distracting you from the fact that they could not attack your argument itself. And this is enormously successful. It's just a very common technique that people use to attack your argument. The second subtype is to attack the situation of the person by showing that the person has a bias. An example of this is when the tobacco companies defend their product, claiming that there is no link to cancer by smoking their product. Their critics point out that they have a bias, that they cannot possibly be fair, because it's their product and they want to sell it, and they're not going to admit that it causes cancer, even if it does. Well, this is a logical fallacy. If you want to attack the product, the tobacco product, and link it to cancer, it's a logical fallacy to try to do so by claiming that the company is biased and therefore their position must be wrong. In fact, they may be right. It is up to the opponent to show that the tobacco company is either lying or hiding evidence. More importantly, it is up to the opponent to actually prove that there is a link between tobacco and cancer. So I'm not going to get into the tobacco cancer debate. That's not the point. I'm using that as an example to show that when you attack an argument, you can't attack the bias of the person presenting the argument, because determination on whether or not it's true or false does not depend on the bias of the person making the claim. It depends on the claim itself. It depends on the evidence and proof that they produce versus the evidence and proof presented by their opponents. Another subtype of the ad hominem attack is to throw the argument back at the person. This is similar to the fallacy known as U2. This is a third grade arguing technique that is so common. Again, it's something you've probably heard every day of your life. An example would be in the argument between skeptics and religion is when religious people say to skeptics that they take science on faith. Therefore, it's no different than religious people taking their religion on faith. What they're doing is they're taking the skeptical argument and throwing it back at them. And this is a logical fallacy. This does not support their position. It is not evidence. What they're doing is basically what the purpose of every logical fallacy is, which is to distract from the fact that they don't have an answer. If a skeptic says to a religious person, you have to produce proof or else your position is based on faith, the duty of the religious person then is to produce evidence or to admit that they are taking it on faith. In fact, skeptics would have no problem with a person who's intellectually honest enough to admit that their position is based on faith. There's nothing wrong with that. You can have faith in God. You can have faith in all kinds of things. If you have the intellectual honesty to admit that that's what you're doing, there's no problem. The problem is that that's not how it works. When people don't have evidence or proof to support their position, what they do is they resort to the irrational bag of tricks and try everything they can to convince you that they do have evidence and proof. It's intellectual dishonesty. That's plain and simple what it is. In the case of this example, throwing the argument back at the person is not a reply. It's not producing evidence. It's not producing proof. It's not supporting your position. All it's doing is taking the argument and throwing it back at the person. Probably the most common place to find this is on a third grade playground, because that's the technique that worked then, and it's the technique you'll find that adults use the rest of their lives, I guess because it works so well. When people do this, when they use this argument where they throw it back at you, as I said, the purpose is to distract you, well, they're very successful at doing that. When someone takes your argument and throws it back at you, you have to realize what game they're playing with you. Don't fall for it. Don't start defending the argument that they've thrown back at you. Realize that they're avoiding answering your question, and then stand up to them and demand that they answer your attack or your claim or whatever it is you presented. Don't let them trick you into defending your position when they refuse to defend theirs and tried to play this little game with you. It's very common and it's very successful. And the only way you defeat it is you have to be aware of it. All through life, you're gonna see this on television, on talk radio, in your own lives. You will see that people will use this all the time, because ever since the third grade, it works. It works great. Another subtype of the ad hominem attack is guilt by association. An example, I'll use the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and an organization known as NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. In case some of you don't know what that is, that's an organization devoted to educating men in the techniques in obtaining and having sex with young boys. ACLU came under some amount of fire for defending this group and their right to exist for free. And I think they came under fire rightfully so, although that's another issue. In our system, everyone deserves representation. I'm not saying that NAMBLA doesn't deserve representation. I just question why we have to pay for representation and a huge amount of money. Lawyers charge very high fees, but they didn't have to pay a dime. That one's kind of beyond me, but that's another point. To get back to what we're talking about, guilt by association. In the case of the ACLU defending NAMBLA, someone could say to you, you support the ACLU, and you reply, yes, I'm a big fan. And they reply, ACLU supports NAMBLA, and therefore you support NAMBLA. That's a logical fallacy. It's a subtype of the ad hominem attack on your argument by claiming that because you support the ACLU and the ACLU supports NAMBLA, that therefore you support NAMBLA. Well, you may support NAMBLA. That might be true. But you can't deduce that fact simply because you support an organization that supports NAMBLA. In fact, there are probably many people who support the ACLU who do not support NAMBLA. So it is not a proper conclusion to draw. Now, it gets a little more complicated. I've given the subtypes of the ad hominem logical fallacy. But it's not as open and shut as you might think. There's a lot of considerations that you have to take into consideration when you consider the ad hominem attack. One of those is reliability. Has the person lied in the past? Is this person reliable? If someone makes a claim and you have to evaluate that claim, then the question is, how do you evaluate that claim? Or if you have knowledge that this person has lied before, you might say, well, why should I believe him? He's lied in the past many times. To use reliability to draw the conclusion, you can't do that. That would be a logical fallacy because it is possible that in this case, the person is telling the truth. However, this is where it gets a little more complicated. While you can't draw the conclusion that the person is lying simply because they lied in the past, it is valid that you use this as a consideration in forming your opinion. And in fact, it's probably a very important factor. This would be considered a piece of evidence. Even though you can't prove that in this case it's a lie, it is something that you definitely want to consider in forming your overall opinion. The logical fallacies, as you'll find as we go through these, are very complicated. It's not that easy. The English language is just so complex, and there's so many things you can do with it. And when you're forming opinions and people are telling you things, you've got to say, well, how do I know this is true? Well, you have to think, and you have to think rationally and come to a rational conclusion. And when you come to a rational conclusion, you do so based on evidence and proof. And reliability would be one piece of evidence that you would consider when you form your final conclusion. But the final conclusion cannot be totally based on reliability. Another consideration would be motivation. For example, a criminal gives testimony in return for a lighter sentence. That's certainly strong motivation to lie. Does that prove that he's lying because he's getting a lighter sentence in return for his testimony? No. That would be a logical fallacy to draw the conclusion that his testimony is false simply because he has motivation. Again, like reliability, it is a factor. It is something that you have to consider in forming your final conclusion, and it's an important one. Going back to the tobacco company, they certainly had motivation for lying. But that doesn't prove that they did lie. They may, in fact, have conducted experiments which prove their position. But you can take into account their motivation. You can take into account their reliability and use these things to weigh all of the evidence so that you can come to a true conclusion. Another consideration that is very important is lack of expertise. Someone gives testimony or makes a claim, you're arguing with someone, and they take a position, and you are wondering, well, why should I believe this person? You've learned about appeal to authority, so if someone important says something to you, you know better than to just blindly accept it because he's important. So how do you know what to believe and what not to believe? Again, this is a complex thing because you don't. There's a lot of things you have to take into consideration. As mentioned previously, the reliability of the speaker, any motivations he may have, but also his expertise or lack of. Let's talk about the word quantum for a second. This would be a great time to introduce this. Whenever you have any kind of discussion with someone, or whether you're on an internet website and you're reading the blogs, people who believe in pseudoscience, alternative medicine, all the things for which there is no proof, it seems like the magic buzzword that they all want to use is the word quantum. It's amazing. All these people who barely fought their way through chemistry high school classes, and yet all these people have no problem at all understanding quantum physics. It's amazing. So they're explaining their belief in some pseudoscience, and how do you know whether it's true or false? And that's an interesting, you know, it's not that easy. How do you measure their expertise? First of all, they're going to claim to have PhDs. They're going to use buzzwords like quantum physics. How do you know if you're being snowed or if they really know what they're talking about? Well, that's one of the considerations that have to be taken into account when you're coming to a conclusion. You use these things to draw the conclusion. But lack of expertise. For instance, if someone makes a comment about chemistry and they're a chemist, you're not going to have much of a problem with their expertise. But you may know that this person is not a chemist, but maybe they had a class in chemistry. And you rightfully say, well, why should I believe you when, you know, you haven't had any more chemistry than I have? What knowledge or expertise do you have in the field of chemistry? So this is a valid point. This is something you're going to use to come to your conclusion. But it's not something that you can use to discredit the person. If you discredit the person based on lack of expertise, then you have committed a logical fallacy because his position may in fact be true. One of the emails I received from William, he wanted me to go over again something I discussed on the debut show last week, which was the scientific method. The scientific method is a process whereby mankind seeks to learn the truths of the universe through a series of steps that consist of four things. I'll go into these in more detail now than I did last week. And this is very important because the scientific method is basically what determines what a skeptic believes. If it's provable, if there is evidence and it is accepted in the scientific community, then that is what a skeptic is going to believe. If there isn't support in the form of evidence and proof, then in fact it may be true. But until there's evidence and proof, a skeptical mind will not accept it as true until that proof arrives. Now, you can have hope that sometime in the future, what you want to believe will be true. There's nothing wrong with that. But to believe it's true when there's no evidence or proof, that is the definition of an irrational thought or an irrational belief. So the first step in the scientific method is known as hypothesis. And in the field of logic, it is known as the premise. And this is where you look at the world around you and you're confused by something. So let's say the northern lights. And you want to find out, well, shoot, what are those things? I mean, what's going on here? Is that God speaking to me? Is it some kind of phenomena in the atmosphere? So you form a hypothesis. You make a guess. In arguing, you would state a premise. Once you have this to work with, then you go to the hard part. Now you've got to gather evidence. And gathering of evidence is subject to the principles of reasoning. And this is where rationals and irrationals have a lot of problem, because when irrational people want to believe something for which there is no evidence, they don't admit they don't have evidence or proof, because intellectual honesty is a very rare trait. What they do is they redefine evidence. For instance, if they want to support their belief in God, they will look at a waterfall and point to it and say, there's the proof. What clearer proof could you want that God exists than that waterfall? And to them, that's proof. For them, anything is proof. To some people, it's proof that gravity will pull water down a mountain. But to irrationals, that's all the proof they need to support their belief in God. Now, I'm not going to say that if they want to prove that there's God, there's evidence that they could produce, but that is not evidence. But they will argue that it is. Someone who believes in astrology will say, well, my reading was exactly on the money. That proves astrology works. Once you know how astrology is done, how it is performed, then you would understand why that reading was probably very similar to what you experience or what you believe is representative of yourself, and it's not evidence. There was an interesting experiment in astrology that was done. It was just a classic. It was done in a classroom where horoscopes were passed out to everyone in the classroom. 30 kids all got these horoscopes, and they were reading them, and their task was to state whether this horoscope was accurate. Was this horoscope accurately describing them? Over 80% raised their hands. They all believed that this was a true horoscope that represented them. They were then asked to pass it over their shoulders to the person behind them. Of course, the person at the back brought it all the way to the front. Then they turned over the horoscopes and they all began rating. And pretty soon everyone was laughing because what they saw was that the horoscope that they were now reading was exactly the same as the one that they were just reading. In other words, everyone was reading the same horoscope. Almost everyone in the class agreed that it was very accurate. That's because they're written that way. That's the whole purpose of them. That's how they get you to believe it. They write very vague things that could be true of almost anyone. Now, people who want to believe in astrology are going to accept what they read as evidence, as proof that astrology is true. And that's up to them. If they want to do that, that's fine. If you want to do that, that's up to you. But if you want to think rationally, if you want to use your mind to actually weigh evidence and proof and come to reasonable decisions and conclusions, you have to know the tricks that are being used on you to trick you, because they're very, very successful. As you listen to the show, or if you go to my website at theskepticarena.com, you will find links to many sources that will teach you about all of the techniques that are used to fool you, to get you to believe things that are not true. For instance, talking to the dead. It's done through a technique called cold reading. And it's kind of similar to the experiment I just told you about with the classroom and the astrology. Let me tell you briefly about one very interesting test. When I was a young skeptic, I considered myself unarmed. I had good skeptical instincts. I just tended to know that the answers, I didn't look to the supernatural for answers for things I did not understand. So I had good skeptical instincts, but I didn't know how I was being tricked. I was an unarmed skeptic. But through training and education and getting further involved in science, I learned how many of these things are done, and one of them was firewalking. Now, so I just knew instinctively that there was nothing supernatural going on, but I didn't know how they did it. I couldn't explain it. I didn't fall for it and think, well, then that's magic. I knew better than that, but I didn't know the trick. I didn't know what was going on. But on my website, like I say, you'll find many links to many great sources that will explain firewalking and all of the other pseudosciences that are out there and tell you just how these things are done. It'll tell you how you're being tricked, how you're being made a fool of. And these things work great. They fool almost everybody. It's just amazing the lack of rational thinking that goes on. And the purpose of this website this show is to try to improve the rational thinking skills. And as I said in the opening show, not just of the listeners, but of myself as well. When I come to an irrational conclusion, I want you people to jump all over me and straighten me out, because rationality is never a final result. It's a constant progressive trip. A never-ending search for truth and reality. So I got a little bit sidetracked with those stories as I was answering the email regarding the scientific method. After the gathering of evidence, the third of the four items involve testing or experimentation. These tests and these experiments must be falsifiable. And what that means is there must be a way that they can be proved false. If you make a test or an experiment, or you design a test or experiment that cannot prove your hypotheses false, then you have designed nothing. It has to be falsifiable, and it has to be reproducible, which means when you give the details of how you conducted your test or your experiment, the results have to be reproducible by others. Because when these things are tested by other people, they may not get the same results. They may do it in a different way, or they just may happen to get different results than you did. But things like gravity are going to always produce the same results. In science, only things which are reproducible are accepted as true science. If it can't be reproduced, then it was probably a trick. And then these tests and experiments must withstand scrutiny as to the validity of the test. For instance, was the test double blind? Well, let me use something that just came out in the news a month ago. A stunning display of how the media will just lie right to your face. People think, well, if they put it on TV, it has to be true. It was on the news, so it must be true. Acupuncture. I put on the news, and they say, new study shows acupuncture beats Western medicine. 47% of the people who got acupuncture when questioned 6 months later had reduced back pain, while only 25% of the people who use Western medicine techniques, such as physical therapy and drugs, reported improvement. And they were trumpeting the victory of acupuncture. I changed channels. I hear the news story again. Once again, it was just like they took it off the other station. Acupuncture defeats Western medicine 2-1, 47% to 25% in a test of reducing back pain. Well, then I finally get to an honest news source on the internet, KFWB. I'll go ahead and mention it since honest people deserve to be mentioned. And it turns out that the TV stories left out something you might consider a little bit important. In fact, it makes the entire thing a completely different conclusion. That's how important it is. What they left out was the fact that there was a third group in this acupuncture study. And this third group, they received acupuncture, but it was a little different than the people who reported the big improvement. These people were given acupuncture where the needles were inserted to a depth where they could not have possibly affected anything. They barely broke the skin. But the people didn't know this because they're not acupuncturists. So they thought they were getting the real thing. And just to make doubly sure, the needles were inserted in the wrong places so that it couldn't possibly affect the lower back. So they made double sure that the people getting the fake acupuncture were in fact getting nothing. The results were that the people who got absolutely nothing reported almost the exact same percentage of improvement as the people who got the acupuncture. And this is just incredible that the media could leave that out, because what it shows is that getting nothing at all did just as well as acupuncture. The people who thought they were getting acupuncture improved just as much as the ones who did, which means that the reason for the difference between the Western medicine and the acupuncture would be attributed to the placebo effect, which is a very real effect and well-documented effect that the human body will heal itself if given enough time. And one of the things that affects the placebo effect is strongly affected by is the outlook of the patient. People who were getting acupuncture actually believed that they were going to get real relief from their problem. It had a stronger placebo effect. So an honest report would have been that acupuncture does have a benefit because people have more faith in it and believe it will help them more than standard Western medicine. And if they had said that, then skeptics would not have had a problem with their reporting. But they didn't do that. They wanted to cater to the public's desire for alternative medicines. Anything that comes out that supports pseudoscience or alternative medicine, the media will grab it up. And then finally, the fourth and final part of the scientific method is the conclusion, which is accepted as fact until it is disproven or replaced by a better conclusion. The thing about science is it's never static. When you can prove that you have a better theory and you can prove through evidence that that is true, then science will adjust itself. In the world of pseudoscience, the opposite is true. They disregard any evidence that contradicts what they want to believe. Science doesn't take the position of what it doesn't care what it wants to believe. It only believes what proves to be true. And that's the show for today. And next week, the topic will be another logical fallacy. Continue to send in your emails, which you can, if you go to theskepticarena.com, you can click on the email link and send me a topic and tell me what you want to hear. Okay, so that's it for today.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.